We are studying from the book of Philippians, and we are in chapter 4, just ready to start into chapter 4 of our study. And as we get into this final chapter of the book of Philippians, there are some things to look forward to as we study through this section. We're going to see, for example, that Paul spends some time praising the Philippian brethren in chapter 4. That fits with the demeanor of the whole book in which he's trying to encourage them and lift them up. That doesn't mean that there isn't some rebuke that is necessary. We're going to see that in our study this morning, that there is some rebuke that was necessary for the Philippian brethren. And yet, its overall theme is one of being encouraging to those brethren. We're going to see in chapter 4 some specific applications to the principles that Paul has laid out for them. We're going to see how he wants them to take those principles and apply them to a specific situation or circumstance that has arisen so that they can fix a problem that had arisen there in Philippi. And as I mentioned, a lot of encouragement going on in chapter 4 as well for these brethren. We're going to see Paul emphasize his relationship with the Philippian brethren a lot in chapter 4. We're going to see him talk about how he feels about them and the relationship that he has with them. Later on in chapter 4, we're not going to get to it in this part of our study yet, but we're going to see that there was a financial relationship between the Philippian brethren and Paul. They were helping to support his work in other places as he left from Philippi. But more important than that financial bond was the spiritual bond that Paul had with these brethren. And it is reflected in the way that he talked about them and how he refers to them and the relationship that he has with them. And so we're going to see Paul writing to them, not only as an inspired man, that's not to minimize his inspiration by any stretch of the imagination, but we're also going to be seeing him write from the perspective that he is a true friend and brother to these brethren in Philippi. And that's reflected in the things that he has to say. And so our text this morning, we're going to be focusing on the first four verses of chapter 4 of Philippians. Let's go ahead and read that. "Therefore, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved. I implore Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. And I urge you also, true companion, help these women who labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice." Well, as we start into this section, we need to recognize that Philippians chapter 4 and verse 1 is kind of a transition between the ideas in chapter 3 and chapter 4 as we have them broken up. If you remember the last lesson, I said that that verse 1 goes with the end of chapter 3, and so the chapter break is kind of in a bad position. Well, I think that the chapter break could come a long way after this, because chapter 4 and verse 1 not only ties the ideas of chapter 3 or sums up or wraps up the ideas of chapter 3, but it also sets the stage for what Paul wants to say in chapter 4. In chapter 4 and verse 1, what we see Paul doing is he really starts to talk about this relationship that he has with these brethren. And it's out of that relationship that he's writing the words that he's writing, the encouragement that he's writing to them. He wants them to understand the feelings he has for them as he writes these words that of encouragement and also rebuke that are going to come in chapter 4. He references here his care for the brethren in this verse, in which, at least in the New King James Version, he uses the term beloved twice in that one verse. And I think that that's a pretty important thing to recognize, is he's using the same word twice to emphasize that relationship. Strong's defines that word beloved as to be beloved, to be esteemed, to be dear to someone, a favorite, someone who is worthy of love. And so Paul is telling these brethren that they are highly esteemed in his life, in his mind. He thinks a lot of them. They were important to him. And he has a great desire to have the opportunity to go back and see them again. He says in this verse that they are his longed for brethren. He longs for the opportunity to be with them or to see them again. And that's an idea that he's already mentioned in the book, back in chapter 1 and verse 8. He says, "For God is my witness how greatly I long for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ." And so he wants to be able to see them. In fact, he follows chapter 1 and verse 8 with some ideas that follow about, well, if I get to come or if I don't get to come, if I'm with you or if I'm not with you. He tells them that their actions need to be the same, but it still reflects that idea that he wants to see them. He wants to be with them at least another time. Paul described these brethren in this verse as being my joy and my crown. And so the brethren were a joy to Paul, and we're going to see they weren't perfect, but they could still be a joy to him, even though they weren't perfect. And he also says that they are his crown. And another definition for you from Strong's is that crown is that which is an ornament, something that is an honor to someone else. And it's a word that's often used. I noticed that it was used in the scripture reading this morning. It's a word that is used to describe the final reward. Paul also uses it in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, where he said, "I have fought a good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness." It's that prize to which he was trying to reach, the prize he was trying to gain. Now, some people say, well, that's how Paul's using it in this verse. Well, I don't see that. I don't see how he could be using it to describe the eternal crown when he's talking about the relationship with his brethren. In fact, if we look at the crown that he's talking about as being futuristic, then the joy also has to be futuristic that he says that these brethren provided. And so it doesn't make any sense, at least to me, that he's talking about something in the future. He's actually talking about something that he possessed right then. They were his joy. They were his crown. And I think it's a reflection of the idea that they served as an honor to him. He had worked among them. He had converted probably most or many of them. And therefore, they were a very tangible aspect of his work that he could point to and be proud of the fruit that God had provided to his account. And so I think he's talking about something that he possessed at that particular time and what they were providing for him at that moment in time. Now, he goes on to say, "So stand fast in the Lord." That's been a recurring theme throughout the book of Philippians, is to encourage the brethren to stand fast, to hold on, to do the things that were right. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27, he said there, "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." And so that's what Paul was calling on those brethren to do. And notice that, as we expressed when we were studying that part of our text, that he ties together the idea of standing fast and unity together. That the unity that they could have was based in standing fast in the Lord. Now, what we're going to see as we continue our study this morning is that Paul's going to make a specific application to that concept of unity. He's going to be telling those brethren to deal with a problem where unity wasn't present and expecting them to do just that. But here he's making it clear that standing fast is rooted in being in the Lord. They couldn't stand fast unless they were in the Lord. That was the only way for them to continue the way Paul wanted them to continue. It's a thought that I think is very similar to what John wrote about in 1 John chapter 1. In 1 John chapter 1, We're going to begin reading there in verse 5. He says, "This is the message which we have heard from Him and declare to you, that God is light and in Him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with Him and walk in darkness, we lie and we do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ His Son cleanses us from all sin." And so John's point is that if we're going to be in fellowship with Christ, we have to be obedient to Christ. If we're obedient to Christ, then we're in fellowship with everybody else who is obedient to Christ. And that idea of fellowship is the same idea that Paul is writing about in terms of unity. That we are together in the way that we believe, together in the way that we practice the will of the Lord. And so he's going to be emphasizing that very fact as we move on. But it's the same idea that John is talking about when he says that we have to be obedient to Christ if we want to be in fellowship, true fellowship or unity with one another. That's where that fellowship or unity lies. And if the Philippian brethren wanted to have the right kind of unity, that's what they had to do. They had to stand fast in the Lord. They had to submit to His will in the matter. There are a lot of people who take stands in other places except in the Lord. they take stands in places of what they desire, what they want, and that doesn't lead to unity. There's no way to build unity on human desires. We have to build the unity on what the Lord has said. And I see Paul admonishing the Philippian brethren for that as well. Now, as he goes on in the next verse, in verse 2, he gets to the heart of where the problem lies. And he's going to deal with the problem of there not being unity, particularly between these two women. And he identifies them, and really he calls them out. And he says there in verse 2, "I implore Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord." And so he says, "I implore these women to be of the same mind in the Lord." Having looked at all that we've looked at up through chapter 3, one has to wonder, was Paul laying the foundation in all of that writing, laying the foundation to fix this particular problem? Was he writing all of that to set the stage to get to this point where he could lay out this rebuke of these two women and have them understand what they needed to do to fix the problem? It's evident that there is a problem, and that there is a problem between these two women. Now, what's not identified is the specific problem. Paul does not say what they had a disagreement over. He doesn't say what they were spatting or arguing over when it came to this problem. But what we can do, and I think that we can kind of draw some conclusions based on what Paul says and what Paul doesn't say whenever he's writing this. Now, his first encouragement is to tell them, you need to be of the same mind. You need to be of the same mind in the Lord. And then as he writes about this, we see that he doesn't specify it. And so to me, at least in my way of thinking, it kind of eliminates a couple of possibilities. When I first look at this problem and I say, well, I wonder what the problem was, I ask myself, well, could it have been a doctrinal problem? Well, it's possible, but if it was a doctrinal problem, it seems like Paul would have just dealt with the doctrinal problem. That's the way he deals with doctrinal problems throughout all the rest of his writings, is to say, this is the right answer. This is the one that is right. He doesn't do that. He doesn't step in and say, you know, Euodia is right and Syntyche needs to come around and believe what she believes. And so it doesn't make sense to me that he's talking about a doctrinal problem. Well, then I ask myself, could it be a moral problem? Well, the same problems exist if it's a moral problem. You know, you look at his writings, for example, in 1 Corinthians, and if there is a moral problem that has arisen in the church, he steps in and he says, this is the truth on the matter. You need to fix this. You can't continue. Take 1 Corinthians 5, for example. You can't allow this immorality to continue to exist in the church. Fix the immorality. And he's very adamant about taking care of the problem that existed there in Corinth. He doesn't do that here. And so it suggests to me that it's not a moral problem that has arisen between these two women. And so that leaves a difference in a matter of judgment. That they have some issue between them that comes down or is boiled down to a matter of judgment that they can't seem to get past. And that seems to me to be the most likely scenario based on Paul's approach to it here. Because when Paul addresses the situation, he actually writes about these women as being fellow laborers. See what he says there in verse 3, "And I urge you also, true companion, help these women who labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also and the rest of my fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life." It doesn't seem to me like he is excluding these two women from the group that he lists here as being listed in the book of life. And so it's not a moral problem. It's not a doctrinal problem that would keep them out of the book of life. It's some kind of issue that has just arisen between them in which they're still listed in the book of life, but they have a problem between them and they need to get it worked out. That's the way Paul describes the problem. Paul also calls upon others that are there in Philippi to help resolve the problem that has arisen. It wasn't acceptable for the church to just allow the problem to keep festering. A lot of times when it comes to differences in judgment, we determine in the church it's just okay to disagree, and you know, there may be some things that may work, but a lot of times what happens is that it's a problem that just keeps festering. And it breeds bad blood between two groups of people inside the church. And you end up with a circumstance where there's a division down the middle of the church in which one group wants one thing or believes one thing and the other group thinks the other thing is the better way to do it. You ever heard of churches arguing over things and even splitting over the color of the carpet that's going to be put down in the building? Silly things that should be gotten over, that are just merely matters of judgment that don't really matter in the end. And yet they cause problems. And it seems to me that looking at the way Paul is dealing with this, this was a problem that was causing a problem in the church. It needed to be resolved. It needed to be fixed. And he calls upon the other brethren in Philippi to help to fix the problem between these two women. He calls upon, and the New King James translates it as verse 3, "And I urge you also, true companion." The New King James translates it as true companion, as if he's calling on someone else in particular to step up and help with this particular problem. Now, we're not told who true companion is, who it is that he's writing to. There's been speculation about it. One possibility that seems pretty strong to me is that there is a proper name that was used in the first century that also could be translated as true companion. Barnabas, for example, was son of encouragement. It could be translated or it could be used as Barnabas as a name. The same thing is true here, and there's the possibility that there was a man by the name of Syzygus, which is the Greek term for true companion, that could be in the church in Philippi that Paul is specifically calling on. Whatever the case, there is a person in particular that Paul is addressing and saying, you need to step up and help resolve this problem. You need to step up and do your part to fix what's going on here. And this, the women that are under consideration had been fellow laborers, even with this true companion, had been fellow laborers with Paul, had been fellow laborers with Clement. Sometimes as I study through Scripture, I come upon these people that are listed and I say, I wish we had more information. I wish I could know more about these people so that because they're so intriguing and so interesting. But we're not told anything else about any of these people. Only what Paul writes about them here in Philippians chapter 4. Now, the idea that these women could be helped by the true companion, I think, indicates that they had been trying to work on the problem themselves. He says, help them do this. as if they've already been working on it. They just haven't been able to figure it out yet. And he's saying, you step up and help them to do that. It doesn't appear, based on the way that Paul writes about even these two women that have a problem, that their nature is to be troublemakers. Now, you've probably all been in churches where somebody just had the nature that they were going to cause trouble. It just seemed like they were never happy unless they were causing some kind of problem in the church. Well, that doesn't seem like the nature of these two women. I mean, Paul wouldn't list them as fellow laborers with him and with all of these other folks that were spreading the gospel in that area if that was really the type of person that they were. We see him write about people that were like that. And when he writes about them, he doesn't write with kind words with people who have that kind of an attitude. And so, again, it seems to me, just looking at all the evidence that Paul provides for us here, that they were the kind of women who didn't want to have the problem, who needed help trying to figure out how to get past the problem, and he's encouraging the brethren there to step up and help them to get past this problem. Now, what we've seen in the first three chapters is the pattern for how to get past a problem like this. What we've seen in the first three chapters is the pattern that Paul has laid out to tell people how to make sure to not have these types of differences between them, and if they do arise, how they can put those types of problems behind them. Now, it's interesting to me to note that the solution was possible, even though it was most likely a matter of judgment. If they would respond in a way that showed that they were in the Lord, if they had the right attitude, then they would be able to get past this problem. I want you to remember from our previous studies that Paul addressed the need to have the mind of Christ in chapter 2. He said, this is the way that you're supposed to think, Philippians chapter 2. In verse 2, they were to be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, being of one mind. That would take humility for them to be able to get to that point. They need to have the humility of Christ to be able to respond in that way. They needed to be able to overcome differences by implementing the principles that Paul was laying out for them. If they were going to put this behind them, they couldn't do things through selfish ambition or conceit. If either one of these women were more interested in their own well-being, in their own way of thinking than the other, then they weren't going to get past this. They needed to be submissive. They needed to put the good of their sister ahead of themselves. And so that's what I see Paul saying at this point when this problem has arisen, is you need to go back and put into practice the principles we've already talked about. You need to put into practice the principles that I've written to you about. And then the rest of the brethren could step up and say, yeah, you remember what Paul said? You have this argument going on, somebody else can step in and say, remember what Paul said? You want blue carpet? You want green carpet? One of you needs to stand down. One of you needs to say that I'm going to concede my will to the will of somebody else. I'm going to show the humility of this. I think we mentioned when we were studying that particular part of our text the types of arguments that should exist in the church whenever the members of the church are acting the way that Paul wants them to act is. The only arguments that should come up is no, you do it your way. No, 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 you go ahead and do it your way. And arguing about letting somebody else have their way rather than insisting that we're going to have our way in the matter. Paul had laid out the principles, and now they needed to put those into application so that they could put this problem, this dispute, behind them. Another thing we can look at as we consider this section of our text is the role that women should have in the church. Now, Paul identifies these two women as having labored with him in the gospel. And that's an interesting phrase, and it's one that a lot of people want to jump on and pull out of the context and use it as a proof text to say, well, see, Paul was an evangelist and he labored in the gospel, and he says these women labored with him in the gospel, they must have been evangelists too. That they were doing the same work that Paul was doing, and so there we have women evangelists. We have those who will say that they had some other kind of leadership role. I know there are other places that people point to and say that there's an official office of a woman deaconesses, women elders. Anybody who's been paying attention lately has seen that even in churches that have claimed to be the Lord's church, they've opened the door for women evangelists, women elders, women deacons, those types of positions. And so they use passages like this as their quote-unquote authority for women taking such roles. Well, the question is, does that interpretation of this verse, this one verse, does it violate what we see in other passages? Does it clearly violate what we see in other passages? Some people have proposed the idea that Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 14, and he told women to be silent in the churches in that passage because that was the cultural norm in Corinth. And he was just telling them, you just abide by the cultural norm that is there, and therefore women need to be silent in the church. And then they say, well, and then when he wrote to Philippi, well, that was a much more open society for women, and they could have more power in that society, and therefore he's writing and saying that women in that circumstance, they can be these evangelists just like Paul was. Well, there's a couple of huge problems that I see with that type of an interpretation. The first one is that when Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, he didn't say, I'm writing you these things because this is what's culturally relevant to you and you need to listen to it. What he wrote to them was is that he was sending the same message to them that he sent to all the churches. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17, he said, for this reason, I have sent Timothy to you, who is my beloved and faithful son in the Lord, who will remind you of my ways in Christ as I teach everywhere in every church. It wasn't that there were some things that were right in the church in Corinth that weren't right in the church in Philippi or vice versa. What was right in Corinth was right in Philippi as well. The second thing I see is that Paul wrote to the young man Timothy, who we don't really see him located anywhere for an extended period of time. He was a traveling preacher, much like Paul was. He might have stayed in places for a couple of years at a time, but he was writing his letters to Timothy to be his instructions for an evangelist. And as you read 1 and 2 Timothy, you see that that's the intent that Paul has in writing to Timothy. And what he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 11 is, let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man, but to be in silence. And so when he writes to Timothy, he writes basically the same thing that he wrote to the church in Corinth. Now, we can talk about the specifics of some of those things in those verses, but it's kind of beyond the scope of this lesson. But what we see him telling is that wherever you go in preaching the gospel, this is the role of women. It wasn't that it was based on what was culturally appropriate. It was based on what God said was appropriate. And what God said was appropriate was for a woman to learn in silence and with all submission, and not to teach or have authority over a man. And therefore, whenever we look at Philippians chapter 4, and we're trying to figure out what was the role of these two women that Paul is addressing in chapter 4 and verse 2, we've got to realize that whatever he's telling them can't contradict with other clear passages that we see in Scripture. And so realizing that, we understand that Paul is not saying that these women could take on a role that was condemned in other parts of Scripture. And so their role is not one of teaching or exercising authority over a man, as per what we saw in 1 Timothy chapter 2, but rather that it has to mean something else. And so then we have to ask the question, well, what is their role? When he says they were fellow laborers, the question becomes, well, what were they doing? There are clearly limitations that were placed upon them, that were placed upon all women who would be a part of the Lord's church. But that doesn't mean that they didn't have a lot of work that they could and should be doing. I've been in places where people have used the passages that place limitations upon women as an excuse for women to not do anything. And they thought that the women really had no ability to teach anybody under any circumstances. Well, that's clearly not true from scriptures as well. There are many opportunities that are given to women to teach. We were studying this morning from Acts chapter 16 when Paul went into Philippi. And when he went into Philippi, there he found Lydia, where the women were gathering by the river for prayer. And he converted Lydia. Well, what kind of influence do you think Lydia then had going back to those women that she was normally with at the river for prayer to teach them the gospel message? Seems to me that she would have a great influence over them. You remember the account of Aquila and Priscilla. I think we mentioned that in our Bible study as well in Acts chapter 18. It is both Aquila and Priscilla that comes to Apollos to help to instruct him more perfectly. And it's interesting to me that Luke is very specific about both of them coming and both of them being a part of that, and how many people want to dismiss Priscilla's role in that. That's not fair to her in the context of what Luke wrote for us, is that they were both a part of teaching Apollos. Now that shows us that that can be done without exercising authority over a man. And that's the way that she was able to do that. It's a great mistake to think that there is little or no work for women in the Lord's church today. There are tremendous opportunities for ladies to labor in the gospel. There are great opportunities for them to work right alongside of men. I know as a gospel preacher, I couldn't do the work that I do without my wife being able to do the work with me and to help in that work. It's an important part of the work. And so there are always going to be opportunities for teaching the gospel, even for women. And that needs to be under consideration. It's clear to me that Paul had great respect for women that worked with him. We kind of touched on this point as well in our Bible study a little bit this morning. There are a lot of people who want to say Paul was a chauvinist. Read 1 Corinthians and you're going to see that Paul was a chauvinist in the way that he treated women. Well, it's obvious that he was not. Here he recognized the work that these women had done, and he's doing that before the whole congregation. He's praising them along with the others that had labored with him in the gospel. Remember, this is an epistle. An epistle would have been taken and read before the whole congregation. Everybody was going to know what Paul had to say. Now, I realize that that means he's also calling them out. He's also identifying that there is a problem that they need to fix, but he's also praising them for what they had done in the past. And so even though there is a gentle reprimand that comes from Paul, he still is acknowledging the work that they had done and talks about them as having their names in the book of life. And so using the principles that were laid out throughout the letter, Paul, I see, is prodding them to fix this problem. Fix the issue that had arisen. And regardless of how bad it might seem, he was telling them, you have the tools. You can resolve this conflict that has arisen here. He then goes immediately from this reprimand, and it's a gentle reprimand, but from this reprimand immediately to verse 4 saying, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. On the heels of addressing this problem, Paul says, rejoice. And, you know, it would be easy. And perhaps that's the way that all of us are. It would be easy to be discouraged when somebody comes and tries to correct some problem. I don't know anybody that likes to be corrected. I've never run into somebody who has said, you know, I sure am happy whenever somebody comes and tells me I'm doing something wrong. It sure makes me happy to know that I'm doing something wrong. Nobody likes to be corrected. Now, hopefully, you know, people who are right thinking will eventually get around to where they get over their hurt feelings of being corrected and realize that the person who did that did it in love and that they're wanting to help them out. But nobody really likes to just the act of being corrected whenever that time comes. And so it would be easy to be discouraged upon being corrected. But it's clear that Paul did not intend for them to be discouraged by his correction or his reprimand here. In fact, what we see is that he immediately seeks to pump the brethren up again after the rebuke. It's important, the importance of showing joy is something that we've seen emphasized throughout the book of Philippians. The idea of rejoicing is one that comes up over and over, and now Paul comes back around to that idea. Now he comes back to that point of saying, even though there's a problem, even though I have to rebuke you, even though I'm telling you how to fix it, rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I will say, rejoice. And there's a couple of places that we've referenced several times in our study, Philippians 1:15, and a couple verses after that, as well as chapter 2 and verse 17 and 18, in which Paul emphasizes the idea of rejoicing. And what's interesting about both of those circumstances that he mentions earlier in the book, especially chapter 1 and verse 15 through 18, is that the circumstances were not good circumstances. They were bad circumstances. There were people who were trying to do Paul harm, and even though they were trying to do Paul harm, Paul still concludes by saying, I will rejoice. Well, the question is how can that be? How can you look at this and say, we've just been reprimanded, now rejoice? How can you say, people are trying to do you harm, now rejoice? How can that be? Well, the problem is that what we do in our minds is we confuse the idea of joy with the idea of happiness. Happiness is controlled, I see it, as by our circumstances. When something good happens to us, we're happy. When something bad happens to us, we're sad. And so happiness is more of an emotion. It's an emotion that is sparked by our circumstances. Joy or rejoicing, that's a choice. We decide to be joyful. We decide to rejoice. We make the choice to be that type of a person. We make the choice. If we're a dreary, grumpy person all the time, we've made the choice to be that. And we need to decide what we're going to do and how we're going to act. And so rejoicing is an action. We either choose to do it or we choose not to do it. And that's why Paul could be challenged in chapter 1 by people who were causing him harm, and he could still say, I'm going to rejoice. It's because he made that choice. I'm going to rejoice. I'm not going to allow this to affect my joy. I'm not going to allow it to affect my rejoicing. Acts chapter 16, we didn't quite get to it this morning in our Bible class, but Paul and Silas are arrested for nothing more than casting a demon out of a girl. And yet, what do we see them doing when they're in prison? They're praying and singing hymns to God. That's a choice that they're making rather than sitting in the prison and being melancholy over their circumstances. They could choose to rejoice in whatever circumstances they were in. Paul said here, rejoice in the Lord. And just like we were talking about earlier, he said stand fast in the Lord. He now says you need to rejoice in the Lord. The Lord gave strength to stand. He provided all that was necessary to overcome the evil one. You're familiar with Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 20, in which Paul describes the whole armor of God. But throughout that context, he repeats over and over, stand, stand fast, stand against the wiles of the devil. And the idea is God has provided everything you need to be successful and make it so that you can stand against the evil one. If you put on the whole armor of God, you will be able to stand against the wicked one. If He provides all that we need to stand, we need to understand He also provides all that we need to rejoice as well. Christians have the ability to rejoice even when the circumstances are bad. Even when they seem like there's no way out, Christians have the ability to rejoice. Look over at Acts chapter 5. This is probably the passage that drives this point home the most clear. In Acts chapter 5, we're going to read verse 40 to 42. It says, "And they agreed with him, and when they had called for the apostles and beaten them, they commanded that they should not speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. So they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name." Now think about that for a minute. They were arrested for doing nothing more than preaching the gospel. They were beaten for it. And when they're beaten for it, they leave that circumstance rejoicing. How many of us would think to rejoice as we're leaving the place where we've just been beaten? Even as Christians, sometimes that's hard for us to fathom. And yet, they made that choice. They made that decision that they were going to rejoice even when the circumstances were that dire. And they took their lead from the example of Christ. Look at Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. They're beginning in verse 1. "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted the bloodshed, striving against sin." The imagery that is laid out here for us by the Hebrew writer is to say, how did Jesus withstand all that he withstood? The mockery, the pain, the crucifixion, how did he do that? And I know that a lot of times the way we think is we say something like, well, he was God. It was easy for him. No, it wasn't. And that's what this passage reveals is that he had to have a perspective that was beyond his immediate circumstances. If all we can focus on is the immediate circumstances that we're in, joy is going to be an awful hard thing for the Christian. Because we've been promised that life's not easy for a Christian. We've been promised that there will be persecution. We've been promised that there's going to be turmoil and distress for us as Christians. And so if all we can see is our immediate circumstances, then it's going to be very difficult to be a joyous people. What the Hebrew writer says is that Jesus looked beyond his immediate circumstances. For the joy that was set before him, that which was on the other side of that, it made him to have the kind of rejoicing that he had. The joy that he could have. And that's the way we need to approach it as well. We need to look beyond the immediate circumstances and understand that there is something much greater that is waiting for us, and therefore we can rejoice. How could Peter and John walk away from a beating rejoicing? Because they looked beyond the immediate circumstances and they understood the significance of what they were doing. And that's the same approach that we need to have as well. Well, we'll talk some more next time about chapter 4 of Philippians. But we can begin to see some direct application to Paul's teaching in this final chapter. We can see that the principles that he laid down were going to come into direct application with these two ladies that had a problem between them. They needed to use the plan for unity that Paul had already discussed in the letter. And we can see, you know, whatever the issue of a difference in judgment that might arise in the local church, we can see how now to use those same principles to resolve a difference in the local church. We don't know what their difference was. We don't know what their problem was. But we do know how they needed to fix it. And that's the same approach that we can take. Whatever problem comes, there is a need for us to look at these principles and make application. It starts with being humble, being willing to look out for the well-being of someone else over our own well-being so that we can make sure that we're doing what God would have us to do. And that would help to bring, that will help to bring unity. It would bring unity between these two ladies in Philippi, and it'll bring unity to the Lord's church today as well. And once that unity was restored, they could stop working on that problem. It could stop being a deterrent to the work, and they could get back on track and doing the work that they needed to be doing. And so in the end, they needed to have unity. They needed to rejoice in the Lord. They needed to resolve the problem, and then the resolution of the problem would cause rejoicing in the church there. That idea of rejoicing is a characteristic we choose. And that's what we need to remember. Each and every day, we need to remember that we need to rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice, because it's the choice we have to make. And not let the cares and concerns and problems of life to really wear us down. All right, in the next lesson, we'll see some more characteristics that Paul lays out in this book that describes the life of a Christian, the demeanor of a Christian. He's going to talk about further practices, further characteristics that should define us as Christians, and there will be good applications for us to make to those as well.